Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live in the green space today. And when we're in the green space, you can watch the show as well as listen because we stream live video from here. You can go to WNYC.org and peek in right from the homepage, or you can use the WNYC Facebook page as well. With me now is Cecile Richards, best known as president for more than a decade of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America and the Planned Parenthood Action Fund. What you may not know is that she was deputy chief of staff to House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi, excuse me, and she's the daughter of the last Democrat to be governor of Texas, Ann Richards. Now, Cecile Richards has a memoir, so we'll talk about past, present, and future. The book is called Make Trouble, Standing Up, Speaking Out, and Finding the Courage to Lead. Cecile, thanks for coming to the Green Space. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's wonderful to be here. Thanks.
To the title of your book, you write, to make change, you have to make trouble. What do you mean by trouble?
Well, I think every bit of social progress we've made in this country and around the world has been because people have stood up and questioned whether it's authority or cultural norms. I mean, the women's movement, the LGBTQ movement, the labor movement. And so, as my friend Congressman John Lewis would say, the important thing is to make good trouble. And that's really what this book is about.
Have you been able to make positive change as president of Planned Parenthood, or just mostly fend off negative change because anti-choice Republicans are in control of Congress in so many states for so long?
Actually, we've made enormous change despite the politics. But of course, every time I think mainly male politicians put their own politics ahead of women's health, women suffer. But there's, and I recount in the book many, many episodes, good and bad. But one of the most important things that happened during the 12 years I was at Planned Parenthood was, of course, the day that after a long campaign, President Obama called me to say he was about to announce at the White House that from now on, all women would get birth control covered at no cost in their insurance plans. And that has absolutely revolutionized access to birth control in America. And something like 62 million women, I think, now have it without cost. And we're actually at the lowest teenage pregnancy rate in the history of the United States. So that's good change.
That's good change. What are the biggest threats right now to Planned Parenthood or to contraception rights or to abortion rights in general? Is it the 20-week limit proposals, or what would you say?
So I think that, there are definitely challenges at the federal level, and certainly President Trump has made no bones about the fact that he'd like to make bosses in charge of whether or not women can get birth control again. Although I can say from my experience around the country is that women are not going to let that happen. They've just ended as well the teen pregnancy prevention program, although we're in the court, as are others, challenging that decision since we're making such great progress there. But I think one of the things that's underreported probably, Brian, is that because of gerrymandering in the states, a lot of the state legislatures are really out of step with where women and, frankly, the public is on issues of reproductive health care. That's where I think the biggest challenges are. So it was one of the reasons it's so exciting to see so many women running for office now, not only in Congress, where I think we have twice as many as we're running 2 years ago, but we also have women running for state legislatures, for Senate, and then that's going to be really, really important to change at the state level.
The budget that Congress just passed and the president signed did not include the end of funding Planned Parenthood, as most of them ran on. How did that not happen?
So, one is because hundreds of thousands of people in this country pushed back. And as you know, this was, one of those stories I recount was that, Paul Ryan, although, of course, he's just announced his retirement, too, parenthetically there. But Paul Ryan announced right after the inauguration that by February, there would be a bill on the president's desk that not only defunded Planned Parenthood, but also repealed Obamacare. And that really just lit a fire, I think, among folks all across the country. And we beat that back, and Planned Parenthood's doors are still open all across America. I think one of the things that happened in this most recent budget negotiation was a recognition that it was deeply unpopular to block access to Planned Parenthood. And of course, I think it's so important to remember that there were two women, Republican women in the United States Senate, Lisa Murkowski from Alaska and Susan Collins from Maine, who stood up for women, stood up for Planned Parenthood, and really have prevented the defunding of Planned Parenthood in this most recent session.
Let's talk about your memoir.
Oh, great. Okay. I'd love to.
What part of Texas did you grow up in?
Well, I'm very proud. I was born in Waco, Brian, which is, as you know, kind of a small town, pretty conservative town. And in fact, there's a great story. I won't tell it here since we don't have time, but there's a great story in the book about the birth of my mother, Ann Richards, in Waco. So I'll just leave the audience waiting.
You don't want to tell the short version?
I could tell the really short version. So, I mean, my grandparents were from Waco. You know, they were very humble, kind of Depression era survivors. And when my grandmother was pregnant with my mom, Ann Richards, she, of course, was not going to go to a hospital, either for economic reasons or just you just didn't do that way when you lived in the country. And she had planned for a neighbor lady to come over and cook supper for my grandfather, because of course it was unthinkable that he would make his own dinner, even though she was in labor. But as the story goes, the neighbor lady could not figure out how to kill the chicken, and that was what was planned for dinner. And so in the birthing bed, in labor, my grandmother Ona hoisted herself up on her elbow and wrung that chicken's neck right there in the birthing bed. And that's how Ann Richards came into this world. And that's the kind of tough line of women I come from. So.
So let me play a clip of your mom. This is not the one that I think it's played over and over again, where she's at the Democratic Convention. What was that, 1988, when George H.W. Bush?
I think that's right. That's right, in Atlanta. Yeah.
And she's going, you know, where was George? And he was born with a silver foot in his mouth and all of that.
Yes.
But
a memorable line.
Elsewhere in that speech, and relevant to your book and your, you know, career in women's issues, she also said this.
You know, for American women and the Republican majority, their president have been like a marriage that's gone from bad to worse. You know the story. The guy has a great line. He's sort of cute, and he tells you that life together will be bliss. And then in a few years, he's snoring on the couch while the TV blares on the fifth football game of the day. And the neighbors are screaming about the yard that never gets mowed, and there's a car up on blocks in the driveway. And your household budget is just stretched to the limit, and he's spending all the money on hunting trips, a new shotgun, and a camo jumpsuit. And you're standing there at the sink thinking, I must have been out of my mind.
Now, do you remember the actual political context of that? Was that?
I don't know, it sounds eerily familiar.
Because I'm thinking of this year's, or the 2016 yep. election, where 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump,
yep.
despite everything. And so there, it seemed like your mom was trying to pry Republican voting women away from the party.
Yes, and look, I think we've got a lot of work to do, although I would like to point out, Brian, that Hillary Clinton did get 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. And so I think it's important that we have work to do, but I think there are millions of people in this country. And based on my experience, even this last couple of weeks out on book tour, women are coming out like crazy. I mean, they're not only running for office, they're starting new groups. They're voting in primaries. They've been calling Congress. And so I actually feel like, you know, maybe it took this election to wake women up, but women are on fire, and I think they're the most important political force in this country. And I'm sorry Mom isn't here to see it. Well, I'm really sorry Mom isn't here, because she would have been just incredible on Twitter. I really wish she could see what's happening with women today, because it's incredibly exciting.
You write about campaigning for your mom for governor with a toddler in tow, and you were pregnant with twins. Was your family status a selling point?
Well, it was all I had. It was all, you know, I didn't have much option. But yeah, you've never lived until you've been in the Gilmer Yamboree Parade. And that's the celebration of the yam that we have in East Texas. Yeah, pregnant with twins, trying to get on a pair of suntan pantyhose to be in the float. It was not a pretty sight. But I do think, look, I think that in Texas, you know, it's a big state. And it was important for mom's race, since we never had any polls showing us winning. We had to get out there and do it retail style, you know, and it was a real grassroots campaign.
And your mom was the last Democratic governor of Texas.
That's correct.
What were the years?
Well, she was elected in 90 and then, of course, lost in 94 in the kind of tidal wave that hit Democrats all across the country, including Mario Cuomo.
Turned out after three terms,
yeah.
Even here in New York.
Yeah, it was a big year.
That was the 94 backlash against the first 2 years of Clinton and a Democratic Congress and their failed attempt at health reform. That was a lot of that.
Yeah, and I think, look, it was the first year we saw the really, really far right, and at that point it was termed the Christian Coalition that Ralph Reed had started really influencing and making some of these hysterical far-right claims, and including about my mom. They were a very influential force, and frankly, at that point, took over the Republican Party in Texas and a lot of other states as well, and I think we're seeing their influence continue today.
There's talk now, though, that even Texas could be part of the blue wave this
year. I'm thinking
year.
So.
In a
I'm
number of congressional so. Districts that could flip. Have you been looking at that closely enough to have a thought?
Yeah, and it was fun. I was back in Texas. One interesting thing, Brian, is in this, I was back with Wendy Davis, the state senator who, of course, led that historic filibuster there, and we did a book event, but we were talking about the fact that 58% of the voters in the primary were women in Texas, which is really quite remarkable. And two of the congressional victories in the primary, and these are seats that are pretty assuredly Democratic, will mean that the first two Hispanic women will go to Congress from Texas. Never has happened before. Veronica Escobar and Sylvia Garcia. That to me is a sign that, you know, a state which is really a majority minority state and that undervotes. I mean, folks say in Texas, we're not a red state, we're just a non-voting state. And that's what could really make the difference. And there are several competitive races. I think it's the first time Democrats have competed in every congressional contest.
My guest is Cecile Richards, if you're just joining us, president for more than a decade of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America and the Planned Parenthood Action Fund. Her new memoir is called Make Trouble, Standing Up, Speaking Out, and Finding the Courage to Lead. And we have a question, I think, here in the green space. Hi there.
Hi. I just wanted to thank you, because I realized that over the past 25 years, which is like basically the span of my adult life, I grew up in New York. It was a progressive time around feminism and around a burgeoning of women's rights. And now we have this kind of new wave and this new energy. But I felt during that time that it was a vulnerable period for women, and that there was a big fight that you were on the front lines of. So I want to thank you for that. And just ask you to shed a little light on whether, you know, there was, I just imagine that there might have been some moments that were difficult within that period of time.
I can remember, I don't know, one congressional hearing in particular that was challenging. But look, I think that's, I sort of feel like if we have easy days, then we're probably not fighting hard enough. Because some people say to me, wow, Planned Parenthood, this must be so controversial. And I try to remind them that 100 years ago, our founder was thrown in jail for starting even to hand out information that was totally illegal at the time. My favorite story was right here in Brooklyn. Margaret Sanger and her sister Ethel and a volunteer started giving out 10 pamphlets for 10 cents a piece about birth control. And as the story goes, an undercover cop who posed as a mother came in and busted Margaret, threw her in jail, where she taught all of her fellow inmates about birth control. And to me, that's kind of the spirit. But I do think it's important that, yes, we recognize there are threats to reproductive health care and rights, and certainly equal access. But I also think we have to celebrate the victories and lift them up, because those happened not because people in Washington changed their minds. They happened because people mobilized around the country. And I think that is what is right now, as women are this, you know, sort of shaking the foundation on everything, whether it is on basic rights, whether it's on Me Too and Time's Up. This is a moment for women of all ages, not just young women. But I just was in Sarasota, Florida, and I met a woman who's in her 80s volunteering at Planned Parenthood. She had never been volunteered anywhere before, and she said, now it's time. So, yeah, I think there's room for everyone to do stuff.
Another question here in the green space. Hi.
Hi. Back to Texas politics for a minute. Do you think the Cruz seat is at all possible for the Democrats? Please say yes.
Listen, I think Beto is absolutely giving Senator Cruz a run for his money. I think Senator Cruz is nervous, and I would be too. I mean, it is. He's not well-liked in Texas and not well-liked in Washington. Actually, I don't think he's well-liked in the country. And so it is really, you know, Beto's race kind of does remind me a bit of Mom's in that, you know, one of the things, I think in the last presidential election, we only had something like 46% turnout in Texas, if that. It may have even been lower. That just means what we have to do is expand the number of people that go to the polls, and that is exactly what Beto was focused on doing. So, yeah, it's very exciting, very exciting to see.
Sir?
Yes. In reference to what, do you think that some of the states are preparing Supreme, you know, passing legislation like 15-week legislation, preparing to go to the Supreme Court, because although you know, what you say is absolutely right, the Supreme Court could very well rule against Roe v. Wade.
Yeah.
And do you think that's happening?
Yeah, and thanks for the question, because I would have, if I'd had time, Brian, I would have probably said that's the two biggest threats to me are what's happening in state legislatures and then, of course, the Supreme Court. And I think folks are, I'm sure you've been following this breakneck pace by which this administration is jamming through lifetime appointees to the federal bench. Folks that are voted, you know, that are not qualified, not rated qualified by the American Bar Association, folks with the most extreme point of view, with no judicial experience, and they're going through on party line votes. It's really disturbing. And so I think that, you know, and I know right now we're part of a big fight on, and one of the nominees, Wendy Vitter, that who is up. Whose positions? I mean, she couldn't even answer the other day in a Senate hearing what she felt about the Brown versus Board decision. I mean, this is how extreme it is. But I think all of this is rolling up to an enormous fight for all of us, not just women's rights, but everything. If there is in fact a Supreme Court vacancy under this presidency, so I think there's huge danger there, and it would be. Of course, that would overturn 45 years of established law if, in fact, they overturned Roe.
I think Wendy Vitter said something specifically about Planned Parenthood, too. Am I right?
Oh, she's been, I mean, she is absolutely against abortion rights. She's made out, I mean, she's spoken at anti-choice rallies. She has supported pamphlets that actually link birth control with violent death. I mean, she is about as extreme as you could get. And so it's really important for us at Planned Parenthood that people recognize this is the kind of nominee that this presidency and this president is putting forward. And I mean, this is a lifetime appointment.
I heard the clip of her on Brown versus Board of Education, but she framed it as, I'm not going to take a public position on any particular Supreme Court case to keep my, you know, hands clean of any prejudgment of anything. Is when she puts it in that universal a way, does she cover herself?
I don't know. It was pretty painful to watch. I don't think anyone who's watched that clip would feel confident about her support for either Supreme Court precedent or just some of the most fundamental rights that we have assumed are given. And look, I think everything is up for grabs right now with this administration. There is not a single thing that I think anyone can assume is secure. That, again, is why, you know, it's really why I wrote this book. I feel like every day someone was stopping me on the street or on the subway saying, what can I do? And as opposed to talking to everyone on the subway, I thought, maybe I'll just put it in a book instead.
You wrote about a meeting you had with Jared and Ivanka Trump. Was that before the election or after?
No, that was after the election. And it was actually after the inauguration. And I think one of the reasons I had, you know, that Ivanka Trump had reached out and wanted to talk about Planned Parenthood, and, you know, candidly, I was quite dubious about doing this, but I think that anywhere I can go to talk about the important work that Planned Parenthood does and the millions of women and young people who count on us for care, I have to do that. But ultimately, the meeting really didn't go that well.
In what way?
Well, and it turned out it was with Jared Kushner as well. So I begged my husband, Kirk, to go with me. I said, I'm not going to go by myself. At least I need a witness. And and basically, Jared Kushner said to me that he really felt like if we would just quit providing access to safe and legal abortion in America, he could secure our funding because he could talk to Paul Ryan. And I just said, well, that is not going to happen. Planned Parenthood, we are never going to trade away women's rights in this country for money. And he said, well, the Republicans control everything, and if you want to make a deal, this is the time to make it. And I said, I don't want to make a deal. And that pretty much ended the conversation. But it was really disturbing to think that they would propose trading away a right of women in this country to access to safe and legal abortion for funding.
Where did you get the sense, if you did get one, that that came from Jared Kushner? Is he personally against abortion rights, or was he just seeing a transactional thing to raise with you?
I have no idea what's going on in his head. But I will say, I think that, I think he was trying to make a deal. I think he wanted to be seen as a savvy deal maker. And I thought it was a very naive approach. And I mean, I really did say, look, this is the important work that we do that's going to be difficult for women to access. And I said, Planned Parenthood is a healthcare provider to millions of people, and many of our patients, they have no one else to go to. I think one of the reasons, though, maybe he reached out is because, as you remember, the day after the inauguration, we saw the largest marches in the history of the United States of America for women's rights. And I think they knew that this effort to defund Planned Parenthood was just going to be like a match on dry kindling, as it was.
Question over here. We have somebody, right? Over here. Okay. Hi.
Hi. So I've been an admirer of you for many, many years, and I'd hoped that if Hillary won, you'd end up in the cabinet. And I know you haven't announced what you're doing next. You've got a couple more weeks left as head of Planned Parenthood, but would you consider a run for office?
So that's not my thank you very much. And yes, we all worked really hard. A lot of us worked hard for Hillary, and she would have been an outstanding president. And I hope that she's made it easier for the next woman who runs for president. I believe she has. So I don't have any plans to run for office immediately, but I will tell you, even after I leave Planned Parenthood, one, I'll be a lifelong advocate, troublemaker, agitator for women's rights, for reproductive rights. And I'm going to spend every waking moment I have between now and this November making sure that we get every single person we can registered, activated, and out to vote.
We just have a few minutes left. As daughter of a Texas governor, do you know Barbara Bush?
I didn't know Barbara Bush, but I, you know, have followed her.
We know she's in failing health.
Yes, we do. And it's really, my prayers go out to her family.
Do you have a reaction to the hiring and firing of Kevin Williamson by The Atlantic?
I think it was the right thing to do. I can't imagine that it is considered acceptable the statements he's made about women and about women who have abortions are not only offensive, they're dangerous. And I think we have seen at Planned Parenthood very painfully what it means to have people in both public office and in the media talking about women and women who make these decisions in the way that they have. So I personally think it was the right decision, and I'm grateful for folks having raised the issue.
And for people who don't know that story, Kevin Williamson is a conservative columnist who was hired by The Atlantic recently, despite the fact that he had said at one time, I guess as a snarky quip, that women who have abortion should be hanged. And they let that pass as a one-off, you know, bad taste kind of snark. But then they discovered that he had said more earnestly on at least one other occasion that women who have abortion should be punished in some way.
Right. No, he really doubled down on it. And again, I think we have worked really hard at Planned Parenthood over the last 12 years to try to reduce the stigma and shame that that women are put upon. And particularly, it is really offensive to see people in public office saying the kinds of things they do about women who should be respected, should be able to make their own personal private decisions, particularly about something as personal as pregnancy.
What's your answer just to the direct question from people who do not support abortion rights, who would say, and Ross Douthat had a column about this after the firing of Kevin Williamson, who would say an embryo or a fetus is a human life and we can't morally kill it any more than we can kill born people?
Well, I mean, that, he can have his own point of view. I think that people have obviously wildly different points of view about pregnancy and abortion. And I think that's why it's important that women or pregnant people and their doctors and their whoever they want to consult with are able to make their decisions, not Ross and not any political pundit or politician.
You write in the book that you almost didn't go to the job interview to run
yes,
Planned Parenthood.
I know.
When was that and why was that?
Well, I had to admit it because I felt like I wasn't qualified. And I think a lot of women and a lot of women I've been seeing on the road on this book tour come up to me later and say, I'm so glad you said that. I was worried that I had never run anything this big. It's such an important institution. You know, what if I messed up? And so right before the interview, I was about to call and cancel. And I did what any grown woman would do. I called my mother. And I said, I don't know what to do. And she said, Cecile, get over it. You have got to try. You'll always regret it if you don't. And I hope that's. I sprinkle a lot of Ann Richards' wisdom throughout this book. But one of hers was, you know, imagine the worst thing that could happen. If you can get over that, go for it. And it's been helpful to me the rest of my life. And thank goodness I went. I've been grateful to have this job ever since.
Well, a lot of women in America, and men, are grateful that you did. And we thank Cecile Richards, who has been the president of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America and Planned Parenthood Action Fund for about 10 years, and is now the author of Make Trouble, Standing Up, Speaking Out, and Finding the Courage to Lead. And listeners, if you want to see Cecile Richards in person, she's got a couple of events coming up in our area. First one is this Saturday, April 21st, at Book Review in Huntington. That's on New York Avenue in Huntington Village. That's Saturday at 3 o'clock. And then next Monday, April 23rd at 7 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel's Stryker Center. That's 65th and 5th in Manhattan. And I see there you will be in conversation with Brittany Packnett. So that's like Black Lives Matter meets mm-hmm. Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, it's going to be great. So I can't wait.
Thank you so much for coming
Thank
to
you,
the
Brian.
Green Space.
Thanks for having me.